Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
Shabbat Shalom. Of late, I found myself returning again and again to the opening line of a poem found in Langston Hughes' Harlem, a poem made famous by Lorraine Hansberry's 1959 play, A Raisin in the Sun. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? The short poem is one of about 90 rifting off of Hughes' beloved Harlem and what Harlem represented in the mind of so many African Americans, the yearning of individual achievement and America's supposed promise of equality. The poem and the montage surrounding it of poems asks the question of what happens to a person who, by accident of birth or fate, finds their long-sought dreams to be beyond their reach. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it just shrivel up and go away? Does it linger and fester? Or does it, as Hughes suggests in his allusion to the Harlem riots, potentially explode? It's a poem, as you may recall from your high school English class, that continues to resonate throughout American culture. What happens when that which we have anticipated, what we believe ourselves do, that we've worked so hard to achieve, through no fault of our own, proves unobtainable? From the speeches of Martin Luther King Jr. to Broadway to the Dream Act legislation, it would not be an understatement to say that Hughes' brief bebop modernist lyric is one of the most influential poems of the 20th century, if not the entire canon of American literature. But this morning, I find myself concerned not so much with my own high school education, but the lives of an inestimable number of high school students, college students, early childhood, elementary and junior high students, the present day montage of dreams deferred due to COVID-19. It is, after all, the month of May, a month meant to be filled with proms and prom dresses, graduations and caps and gowns, moving up ceremonies, end of the year athletic playoffs, internships, and packing lists for summer camp. Everyone has been impacted. Semesters abroad have been canceled, job offers to graduates have been rescinded, and long-planned reunions put on hold. I think of the 11th grader who had been looking forward to being scouted by college teams. I think of the ACT and SAT exams needing to be rescheduled and the cascade of implications resulting. I think of the millions of regretful and character-building poor decisions that are every teenager's right to make, but are presently being denied to them. The other day, my daughter stoically shared with me that her final day of high school, the final day that her class was going to be together, had come and gone without her realizing it at the time. I was supposed to officiate at a wedding this week and next week and the week after. So many simchas now being rescheduled. Sometimes life gives us second chances. Yesterday, after all, was Pesach Sheni, for those of you who know, a biblical redo for those who missed Pesach the first time around. But you and I both know that not everything gets a redo. Many dreams have been deferred, and an equal, if not greater, number have been derailed and denied, never to be rescheduled. The sense of loss, of course, is not just about our children and our grandchildren. It's about all of us, about the loss of stability, predictability, and reliability. The very scaffolding of our existence come undone. People on the verge of retirement, now needing to work longer for themselves and for their children and their grandchildren. The rhythms of our day upended, from the most mundane, the risk-reward of stepping into a subway, to the most weighty, the decision to change jobs, to leave an unhappy marriage, or to bring a child into this world. If you stop, if you really stop to consider the number of dreams deferred by our dark hour, it is a thought that can suffocate, and it's a thought made even heavier with the knowledge that the road ahead is altogether uncertain. We just don't know if and how campus life will resume in the fall. We don't know what vaccines are or are not on the horizon. I recently read about a category of loss called anticipatory grief, the feeling we get when the future is so uncertain. None of us know when the light will appear at the end of the tunnel. So like ships lined up off the shore waiting to find safe harbor, the heartache we're feeling is not just about what's been lost, but about the feeling of lost time, being stalled in place as the calendar itself moves inexorably forward into an uncertain future. So what shall we say in response to our dreams deferred? We have no solutions and we have no crystal ball, but people are in pain. We need a response. What shall we say to our children and to our grandchildren? What shall we say to each other? What shall we say to ourselves? It's not an easy question to answer. So let me begin by suggesting what not to say, how not to respond to your child when he or she learns that camp is canceled, when your friend shares that her wedding is postponed, or your nephew graduates from college without a job. First, avoid answers drawn from what I call the "at least you're not dead" basket of response. Your program was canceled? Read the news. People are fighting for their lives. Sorry you have to take the SAT next fall, but at least you have a roof over your head. There are certain moments in life when the first words out of your mouth really matter. When someone gets engaged, you say mazel tov. When a new parent tells you the name of their baby, you say, I love it. When my wife asks me if I like a dress, I do. Most often, there's a time to redirect and recalibrate, but you only get one chance for a first response. And when someone is suffering from loss, do not respond by pointing out weightier losses. It may come from a good place. It may even be an intellectually defensible position, but an indelicate, at least you're not dead response makes a person feel that you don't feel that person's pain to be real. I myself thought long and hard about whether to give a sermon about the loss of high school graduations and such when other people are on ventilators. I decided I had to, because to not do so would be an omission which unto itself invalidates the world of pain that so many are experiencing right now. Rule number one of the first response to a person's loss: don't tell them that in the big scheme of things, they are lucky. And the "at least you're not dead" basket takes on many forms, some more subtle than others. There is the "imagine what it's like to be born in the Depression, to be part of the greatest generation," or we Jews love to say, "to have lived through any number of pogroms or persecutions." Again, it may be true that someone else in another time and place has also suffered, but when I'm in pain, is that really going to help me? It's a bit like when I was a kid and I would complain to my dad, who's a physician, by the way, that my ear hurt. And he would pinch my arm and he'd say, Now what hurts? It didn't make me feel any better when I was a kid, and it doesn't make my kids feel any better when I did it to them. You can't tell a kid that it was never about receiving a diploma on graduation day, but about the hard work leading up to that day. Because in a kid's mind, at that moment, it's all about the diploma. You can have these thoughts in your head. Just don't share them. Not yet, and possibly not ever. Another category of response also to be avoided is the silver lining basket. Camp is canceled. What a great time to take up an instrument or start studying for your ACT. Today's that rainy day, the block of downtime you've been waiting for, to read that book, to take up a pet project, to learn chess, to lose 5 pounds, or finally learn how to mix a margarita. Again, it may be true, and it actually may even be good advice. Just don't say it to a person as they stare face to face with a dream deferred. We're all well familiar with the "what doesn't kill you makes you stronger" response. Telling someone how the best things that happen in life happen in response to setback. Perhaps, but generally speaking, when a door slams in a person's face, they're not ready to hear about the 10 that just opened. Alternatively, to suggest that this crisis will prompt us to re-examine our priorities, to teach us what's really important, the fragility of life, to treat the environment with greater care, is also fraught with problems. I'm reminded of the Talmudic exchange between Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yochanan as he lay dying on his deathbed and was asked by Rabbi Chiya if his suffering was dear to him, a question to which Rabbi Yochanan replied, "I welcome neither my suffering nor my reward." Not all lemons produce lemonade. And like Rabbi Yochanan, I personally would forgo any silver linings if in doing so our present world of hurt could be avoided. I have no idea if this will make us stronger as a society or it will break us, if it will pass soon or prove to be our enduring new normal. All I do know is that we do ourselves and our loved ones a terrible disservice by sugarcoating pain with pithy bromides. So what can we say? What can we say that does not risk pablum or platitude, that isn't tone deaf or insensitive? Rather than tell you what I think, I'll tell you what one of my kids thinks, or rather what was said to me when I asked, "What should a parent say if summer camp is canceled?" My kid said to me, "Dad, what I need to hear, what every kid needs to hear, is an acknowledgement of the pain of the situation. Let me know that you know how much this sucks. Don't tell me to move on. Don't tell me that other people are suffering more. I have looked forward to this summer all year for 8 years, and to not have it happen is a hurt that I cannot even begin to process. What I need from you, Dad, and what every kid needs from every parent is empathy. I know it's not the end of the world, but right now it feels like it is. So support me as I go through this, but know that this is a me problem that I need to solve, not you. I need to let myself grieve. I need you to be present, and I need you to give me space. And confusing as that may all sound to you, it makes perfect sense to me." My kid said all that to me and a whole lot more. And we sat and there were tears shed. And as much as I wanted to fill the moment with words, I think the most important thing I did was I said nothing. There is a reason tradition teaches that when you go to a Shiva house and greet a person who has suffered loss, you're supposed to say nothing. You wait until the mourner speaks to you. Loss is best acknowledged with tears and hugs and with silence, not necessarily with words. It's not one size fits all, but let your North Star be your very presence, your honesty, and most of all, your compassion. When Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro, the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, was asked by his community for a response to their suffering, at first he suggested that perhaps it was an expression of God's will, a punishment perhaps, or maybe a test to strengthen their fortitude. But as suffering increased and words proved inadequate, Shapiro's explanation changed, writing that at a moment of great suffering, God weeps for our suffering, and we, a suffering humanity, weep together with God. Together we weep and are strengthened. We're broken, but we find the courage to go on. It is in the very moment that God seems most distant that God is right there next to us, weeping alongside, supporting us, and wiping away our tears. Maybe, just maybe, the proper and best response to a dream deferred is to perform the godlike act of being present, affirming a person's pain, and standing by ready so that person can put one foot ahead of the other, and then the other, until they can support themselves. From Adam and Eve being cast out of the garden, the story of humanity is a tale of individuals seeking to reconstitute themselves in the face of setback and loss. Abraham and Sarah were barren, Isaac scarred for life on Mount Moriah, Jacob pitted from birth against his brother, and Joseph brought low having been thrown into a pit. The list goes on and on and on. The tale of the very hero of our coming harvest season, Ruth, is a story that begins by noting Ruth's defining characteristic to be her widowed status, a dream deferred if there ever was one. Her story will be one of rebuilding after the rug is ripped out from beneath her. We know that our present losses are but an extension of that ongoing human drama, but it is a knowledge that does not serve to mitigate or ease our sorrow. We, like those who came before, stand outside of the garden, bound on the altar, thrown in the pit, our dreams deferred. And from those depths, Mima'akim Karaticha Yah, we call out to God. We call out and we feel the divine presence of God and godlike friends and family who acknowledge our pain, who sit there at our side, weeping as we weep, and ready, when we are ready, to take a step forward. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.